Hello, I'm Dan, and I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
And talking to a few people, I realized that some people came a long way to hear this. So no pressure there, right? Somebody else pointed out, well, I came a lot longer ways to present this. So that's even more pressure, right? Willing, you know, talk about willing to go to any length. Well, this is a few thousand miles beyond any length, I'd say. You know, there's a lot of hours that I'm going to be talking, and I was thinking that I'd like to start off just by talking a little bit about me and where it all, how it all started for me, and so that you guys can get a chance to hear my story, right? And that will kind of get me rolling into what we're going to do tomorrow, which might get more technical, and so I'd like to get a little bit more personal tonight. And it's certainly going to be offset tomorrow, don't worry. a lot of times I'm in a home group that a lot of people in the area say, oh, you're in that group over there. It's one of those groups. Because they think that we're doing something weird over there, right? And all around the world, actually, I hear stories of similar groups that really all we do is try to understand what the big book is saying, right? And it seems to always be constant levels of deeper understanding of what we can do with the big book. And it's, I really was drawn to that. You know, I was the kind of kid that liked taking things apart. I didn't always get things back together, but I really liked taking things apart. Right? Anything, clocks, appliances. I don't know that I ever got an appliance back together, to tell you the truth. But I liked to. I kind of saw that it was similar with the Big Book and the 12-step process. I started calling myself an AA Big Book 12-step deconstructionist. I made that up a couple weeks ago. my home group, I actually have two home groups. I have one that I've been at since I was a newcomer in my first year of sobriety. It's called the As Outlined in the Book group. It wasn't always called that, but that's its current name. It's been known to be somewhat obsessive. We have five formats. Every week is a different format. It keeps it interesting. It's in Santa Monica. And if you're ever out there, it's Tuesday nights at 7:30. It's a closed meeting for alcoholics only, which just for the first time has actually voted to open it up to be closed for alcoholics participation, but anybody can be there, which was a big deal for this particular meeting, because this was the kind of meeting that if someone didn't qualify as an alcoholic, they'd stop until you get up and leave, right? So I'm sure that was the makings of a lot of people's inventory, right? A lot of people's. But the meeting that I've been more excited about lately has been a newer meeting that's only been going on for about 4 years, and it's a big book study. I call it full contact AA, because we read a paragraph and beat it to death, and you're okay to debate what somebody says about that paragraph. And if it's in the format that says that if you are sharing about anything else besides the topic that we're looking at, that we're going to stop you. We say that up front in the beginning of the meeting. And, the only way that we found to have a focused meeting is to stand up for the format, right? The group conscience is that we have a focused meeting and that we protect the format. And it's the kind of meeting that people get up and walk out of because they don't like it not being like the rest of the meetings. But from where I'm, in the area that I live in Los Angeles, there's 2,000 meetings to go to, right? So, you know, it's nice to have a meeting that's a little bit more focused. And in order to do that, as I said, we have to stand up for that format. And it doesn't always make you popular, right? I remember a time a couple months ago where a lady, all through the meeting, she was shaking her head like this, right? And at the end of the meeting, during the announcements, she raised her hand. She wanted to say something really, really important. And she says, you people are going to be killing alcoholics. Newcomers are going to die if they come here, right? And she went on and on for about 5 minutes, just hysterical about the meeting format because we were trying to stay so focused. And being one of the older members of the group, I wanted to stand up and protect the group. That was what was going on in my head. It's like, I got to defend this. And it's like, you know, I just kind of waited. And what had happened before I even could say anything, 10 newcomer women actually talked back to her and said, this is the only meeting that's made sense that we've been to so far. And they all, the new people were protecting the format to this person. It's like, because they had, some of them had experience of coming in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous and never understanding what is Alcoholics Anonymous about, right? And so that's the meeting I feel closest to right now is that one. So that probably is really my home group. And it's on Thursday night at 7:30 in Santa Monica. If you're ever out there, it's easy to remember what the name is. It's the Thursday night big book study. I know, it's not very creative, is it? So my sobriety date is February the 23rd of 1989. And I'll agree with those people that say that time's not important. Right? I agree with that. Time's not important. But I certainly do that time was going to be a testament to what you've done in that time, and the way you behave and act and your spiritual condition is certainly going to be a reflection of what you've done. So I like to say that time isn't important, but what you've done with your time is important. Right? And, you know, I've seen plenty of people with a lot of time that I don't want what they have. Right? And I've seen people with just a year who finished the process, 12-step process, and have more to give somebody else than those people with a lot of time that don't work with anybody. So, you know, I think that it's... my story was a little different. Because I didn't have the kind of story where I hung around Alcoholics Anonymous for a decade before coming across somebody that could take me through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I fell into that my first year, right? So, but I'm going to roll it back a little bit and just talk about from where it began, and that was I was 15 and a half. And my mother met this guy who owned a gas station. I started hanging around this gas station. And before that, I had been moving around a lot. So my family didn't really stay in one place a long time because my parents kept separating. My dad lived in England. My grandmother lived in Venice, at Venice Beach, California. Probably seen a lot of pictures of that on television, right? And I lived like half a block from my grandmother's house was half a block from the beach there, so it was a great place to grow up. And, you know, but we were going back and forth from England to my grandmother's house. And so I never really acquired a lot of friends, but here I start hanging around this gas station, and some 40 or 50 guys would just kind of wander through the gas station and hang out for a while and leave over a weekend. Right, so there was always something to do there, and that's kind of where it all started for me, because I'd just go over to this gas station, hang out, and we'd walk over to the liquor store and do the things that kids do, you know, hang out in front of the store and wait for someone to come by and get them to buy us booze, right? And started off drinking, embarrassingly enough, something that was called Strawberry Hill. It was those wines that I don't know that I could say that it ever really got me drunk, but it certainly got me started, right? And and soon found that beer worked a lot better than Strawberry Hill wine. And for some reason, it was a quart and a can of Colt 45. And I don't know if you have that here. You probably need to drink more beer there than here, because from what I understand, the beer here is much stronger. But I had a solution for that. See, I didn't like drinking a lot of beer, but early on I found that if you poured a little tequila in with the beer, you just don't have to drink as much beer. Right? So, this was about 1969, and there was a lot of things going back then. There was hippies around where we were and around the country, and the Vietnam War was going on, and there was all kinds of stuff going on, but I really didn't care about any of that. I had my little group, and we'd meet every day, and we'd drink, and back then there was a lot of drugs that was moving through this gas station. With that many people moving through one place, somebody always had something, and it was always just different stuff. Certainly a lot of pot. Marijuana, beer, LSD, pretty much whatever came through, I would take. Just because I've done a lot of different drugs and experimented with a lot of things, I don't believe that I was powerless over all of those things. I was smoking a lot of pot, and my stepbrother, who worked in this gas station, he actually became my stepbrother afterwards, walked up to me one day and he says, "Dan, you're starting sentences and you're not finishing them. Did you realize that?" And I didn't. I thought I was horrified by the thought of it, and I thought it must be the pot, so I said, "I'm just going to drink." And I did. I just stopped smoking pot. I had it in my house. I didn't even touch it. It got so old, even my friends wouldn't smoke it, right? And I found early on that there was something about alcohol that, that did something for me. And you hear a lot of people say that same exact thing, but the part that I really relate to in the big book, where it talks about being a real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. See, the thing about Mr. Hyde and Dr. Jekyll, and Dr. Jekyll was kind of, in the story, was kind of meek and, he was the doctor. but Mr. Hyde was aggressive and I don't know if you ever heard or saw the movie Mary Riley. Did anybody ever see that? Yeah. Mary Riley was the story of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde from the maid's perspective, right? And when he was asked, why is it that you keep doing this? And his response was, "I don't know, I seem to like that other personality better than my own." And I so related to that with alcoholism, right? With drinking, it's like who Dan was with alcohol in his system just seemed to be better than who Dan was without alcohol. And that was just my perception, right? I just liked who I was with it rather than without it. And the thought of ever living without that, I couldn't even think of that. It's why would you let go of something that was so great in your life? When I basically rode that kind of attitude towards alcohol all along, is the idea that how could you live life without alcohol? Living where I lived, there was the beach there. We were close to mountains, and alcohol and drugs just became such a big part of my teenage years. But the same thing with the drugs. Over and over again, I would get into experimenting with some particular type of drug and lose interest and just stop altogether. Say, okay, I'm done with that. But alcohol was consistent because alcohol was dependable, right? Alcohol, played a certain role in any direction I wanted to go. If I wanted to be romantic with a lady, I'd Rome was a good choice, right? If if you're just hanging out by the beach, you know, beer was okay, but it was much better when you pour some whiskey into it. And if you're going to go to a party or just hang out with the guys, whiskey was good, straight up, right? Jack Daniels was my favorite. I did this weird thing, and it's totally off topic, but I had this Glenlivet's bottle that I refilled with Jack Daniels over and over again. Glenlivet's was a more expensive brand, but I really liked the taste of the Jack Daniels, and I would fill this bottle over and over again. So when I put it out on the table when my friends were over, right, it's like I was breaking out the good stuff. Right? I'm actually still getting the Jack Daniels calendars every year. All the glasses they sent me broke in an earthquake, actually, years ago. They were great glasses, too. Anyway, ever notice, you know, like the shot glasses, right? Do you know that some people actually use those for a measuring device? Right? You know, so alcohol pretty much had its place in everything. If you know, if you're hanging out with the guys, whiskey was a good choice. If you're going to a party and you knew things might get a little rough or you wanted to be aggressive, tequila had to be the drink, right? I see a couple of people smiling. They know about the tequila thing. And I'm really close to Mexico. It takes me like 2.5 hours to hit the border there. And over there you could buy the bottles of tequila with the worm in it. I don't know if you might have it here because it's probably a novelty here, but we had to drive all the way to the border to get it back then. And they used to tell us that if you drink the worm, it's like almost like eating acid. And it's like, you know, by the time you get down to the worm, it's like you don't care. But alcohol, as I said, it became such an important part of my life that, you know, you couldn't go to a party without bringing it along. You couldn't, dates, you know, if you're going on a date, you had to drink. And it's just, you know, what would life, I couldn't perceive life without it is the point, right? And I continued to live in that place, for the majority of my teenage years and well into, you know, into my adult years. And I never really realized this, but, you know, I started a lot of businesses. Looking back, I see that I started a lot of businesses because working with somebody else would have put a lot of pressure on the way I was trying to live, right? And looking a little deeper into it, I realized that many times I was unhirable because of the way I was living, right? But I was really good at starting little businesses. I just wasn't good at keeping them going, right? Always in this weird kind of survival mode. I'd make things a lot. I'd build things or make things, craft things like print artwork or... I dabbled in the clothing industry for a little while, but I found quickly that I really didn't like that. But, you know, but I believe that any direction I went could have been really good, but the way that I was living along with it wasn't conducive to really keep things going and growing. But I didn't see it, you know, I didn't see it at the time. Some other people around me saw that my life was affected by the way I was drinking. But any reference to my drinking certainly would just piss me off, right? I didn't want to hear it from anybody because, you know, it was like, look at who I am and who are you to tell me say anything about how I should live my life, right? And that includes, I didn't care what family thought about my life, about my relationships, what they thought about the way I was living, right? People that worked with me. And, you know, I didn't hear the word powerless until I got here. Right? Nor do I think I could have ever related to being powerless while I was doing the things I wanted to do, drinking the way I wanted to drink, living the way I wanted to live. Didn't matter about what was going on around it. As long as I was living the way I wanted to live, I was accomplishing what I wanted to do. Right? So, as time went on, the drinking got heavier. There was some drugs there for a while, which I later stopped before I stopped drinking, but that all kind of influenced certain things in my life getting harder and harder to maintain, like the current business. Near the end of my drinking, I somehow seemed to create the biggest business that I had had to that point, or up to that time. The only reason that really happened was because the city of Santa Monica kicked me out of my garage because I had started making picture frames. Manufacturing picture frames and selling them wholesale and doing custom framing, wholesale framing. And Santa Monica is a kind of nice area, and the garage had apartment buildings all around it. And I had guys going in at 7 in the morning with these double-cutting miter saws, cutting oak and metal, right, at 7 in the morning. And I don't know if you've... A couple of people are laughing, because I know that they know what that must have sounded like. But oak is a really hard wood to cut. And when those double-cutting blades came down, they were pretty sharp, but it still made a really loud noise. And Santa Monica, the city of Santa Monica didn't put up with that very long and said, out, right? And that kind of pushed me into this manufacturing area, and that was a pretty wild area. But what it also did is it created a lot more expense. Right, it's one thing to do all of these things with really low expenses, but all of a sudden I got a warehouse and all the things that come along with that, business licenses, and you know, now I had to do it like a grown-up. And I built up a lot of expenses and tore another business down. And during this time, I had met a woman and got married, and I had this wife, and she wasn't understanding what was happening because things were just getting worse all around us. And drinking got heavier during this time because now all this pressure that's going on around me with the expenses of having this business. And anyway, the point is that life was just getting harder and harder to live the way I was living it. And the idea of not drinking never even once came into my mind, right? Because by that time it was like my only pleasure, right? My only pleasure. And the alcohol was more important than the business. The alcohol was more important than the relationship. Got to the point where I figured that if I got out of that, all that expense and moved back into a garage in a more quiet fashion, that I could somehow find my old way of life back, right? And that just never happened. I dumped all of those expenses, moved into this garage, and I still kept drinking more and more. Then I figured, well, I did what the only thing that seemed to make sense is to look around my life to blame what's around me for the condition of my life. And there she was, with the nagging and about my life. And it's like, if I get rid of the wife, right, then things will be much better, right? So I kicked her out, and things didn't get better. Things didn't get better because without that pressure, I was able to drink even more because I didn't have to hide it anymore. And things just seemed to keep getting worse. And one day, I was sitting down on my couch, looking around at my life, and what happened to Dan? What happened to Dan? I absolutely did not know what went wrong, because I thought so much of my ability, of who I thought I could be one day. Right? Growing up, I was sure that I was going to retire by the time I was 30 and show up the rest of my family that it was so successful. And it just never happened. And sitting on this couch, just looking around at my life, I made some decisions. I've got to stop drinking. Right? Because I was no longer living how I wanted to live or drinking how I wanted to drink. Right? Somewhere in that place, I started to develop a new reality, or I should say, a new understanding of the position I was in. Because now, I didn't want to drink like that, and I found myself going to bed the night before, telling myself, this has got to stop, and before I'd even open my eyes in the morning, the thought would come to my mind is, when am I going to get up and get to the liquor store? Right? And then I'd get up and do what I had to do to get out of the house and make that long trip again and again to that liquor store. And it's like, I found myself just yelling at myself out loud as I'd be walking down the street, talking to myself out loud. And what's wrong with you? Why don't you stop doing this? Are you crazy? You know, and I figured that's what it was. I'm crazy, right? And I'm sure that that's the way I looked. You know, I mean, yes. Now it's different when you see someone walking down the street, talking out, or even yelling out loud. You assume they're on the phone, right? Back then, in the 1980s, it meant something different, right? It meant you were probably crazy. You know, so I figured I needed to see a therapist, and I started doing that. And you know, I just never really was completely honest with the therapist. And looking back, I think that I just didn't really ever want to be. There were certain things I just didn't want to admit to myself, or couldn't. Nor could I admit those things to family members or even close friends, for the most part. Right? Maybe I just didn't want anybody to get in my way when that insanity was on me. Right? I don't know. Right? But I just didn't feel like I could really be completely honest with anybody. And over and over again, in the beginning, I kept thinking that something's going to happen. I'm going to make this work. I got to figure this out. Yeah, it's crazy, but I've got so much ability. I thought I was an intelligent person. I was going to figure this out. And I know some people are probably tired of hearing me say this, because I say it all the time. But I hear it all the time in Los Angeles, where people say that insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. And that's probably true for most people, right? But for an alcoholic of my variety, as long as I was expecting different results, I had hope. As long as I had hope, right, then I still really didn't get the idea that I was trapped in a situation that I couldn't do anything about on my own. Right? I didn't think that that was the case. But 2 years into this period of trying over and over again to stop, it just chipped away at a little bit more of that piece of me that thought I could do the job on my own. And I really believed that there was nobody in the world that understood what was going on with me, what was wrong. I didn't think anybody in the world could possibly understand it. Even the therapist didn't seem to know what to do with me. Didn't once suggest Alcoholics Anonymous. Right? Didn't once. One time he says, I go over there and he says, you know, I went to a convention this weekend. I said, really? Yeah. And he says, yeah, it was on alcoholism and drug addiction. And I thought, good, what did you learn? He says, I think what you need to do is meditate. Right? So I had never done that. I said, I don't know how to meditate. He says, well, I said, could you show me? So here I am at $170 an hour is actually what it was, sitting there with my eyes closed, you know, and you know, on the way home, I stopped at the liquor store, right? Obviously, just threw me deeper into a place where, okay, the therapist doesn't know what to do with me. I don't know what to do with me. I was getting more and more depressed about the situations in my life. I was, as I said, I threw the wife out, so I was alone, and she was such a nice woman when I met her. She was so nice. I don't know what happened, right? But I realized that I was driving myself crazy. I could see how it must have really affected her, you know. But near the end of that 2-year period that I'm talking about, around the beginning of 1989, I got into an argument with one of my brothers, and some other stuff happened. I was feeling really bad about the way I was surviving at that point, because I wasn't working and I was managing some property that belonged to my family. So nobody knew that I couldn't afford rent. And my job got so important in my mind that I started cutting a check every month for living expenses. And, you know, the guilt of that started weighing on me, and I just said, enough's enough, and I couldn't bear to live like that anymore. Right? On another one of those trips to the liquor store, I remember standing at the corner thinking, the only way I'm going to stop drinking is to jump out in front of one of these cars. Right? And I didn't realize how true that was, but see, I was doing the same thing over and over again, knowing that I was never going to do it differently. Right? And I had lost all hope. And when that happened, the best solution that came to me was to pull the .357 Magnum out of my drawer, you know. And they say an alcoholic always aims for the noisiest place. I just couldn't figure out which was noisier, the back or the front. So. And there was a split second there where I realized that this was my brother's gun, and he was already on the run from emptying a shotgun on one of his friends, and that's a whole other story. But you know, and the last thing I wanted was for them to start looking for him for what happened, for what I did to me, you know. So, and I just looked up, and I didn't believe in God, not in the condition of my life was in. Right? But I just looked up and just said, help. And I don't know what I said help to, or, you know, if you would ask me if that was a prayer, I'd say absolutely not. There's nothing there. I mean, look at the way most of us come in, you know, not full of God usually, right? Not full of a life that reflects that, you know. My life reflected, you know, a place of despair and hopelessness and, you know, loss, and you know, and I just looked up and said, "Help!" Right? And just a couple days later, I bumped into an old friend from that gas station. His name was Brian. Right? And it's just a couple days later, after I uttered those words, a friend of mine uses the term. He says, "Is that odd or is it God?" Right. I didn't even recognize him. His face was clear, his eyes were clear. Picked up his sunglasses and he had to say, "It's me, Brian." Right? That's how much different he looked. And it was a little disturbing to see Brian in such good condition, because he looked better than me, and Brian was always the one that looked worse than anybody. Right? Brian had 9 lives, like a cat. He was always in situations that people around him died. Right? His first two girlfriends committed suicide. His best friend, they stole the little Triumph and it flipped over, and his friend died and he got thrown clear. It was just story after story. There was probably at least 8 of them, right? But here he was in better condition than me. And we started talking, and for some reason, there was something different about talking to Brian, different than talking to the therapist, different to talking to my family, much different than talking to my drinking friends, right? Because here's someone that I always consider. He was a nice guy, but he was just, nobody expected him to live that long, right? Right? And here he is in better condition than I am, I just felt that I could be completely honest with him and tell him what was going on in my life. And he knew exactly how to talk to me, because he had been going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, right? He had gotten 1.5 years sober. And he got that look in his eyes, right? You know the look when somebody catches a fish, right? It's like, that's the way he kind of looked at me, right? I didn't understand it at the time, though, right? But after we talked, he says, you know, I'm going to these meetings regularly, and if you want to go, I'd love to take you. And I thought for a minute, and I says, you know, meetings, I don't think I'm that bad yet. I really said that. I think it had a lot more to do with fear of confronting, of being honest about this with other people. And I don't know what it was. What came out of my mouth was no. But it didn't take too many days after that to call him up and say, hey, you know, tell me a little bit more about these meetings. Right? Didn't once mention anything about the spiritual aspect or the God thing, which was probably lucky, because I probably would have just said, absolutely, I don't want anything to do with you anymore, right? But luckily he knew that, he sensed that about me. And he ended up taking me to my first meeting, and you know, the rest was history. I never drank again. And that was the biggest miracle that ever happened in my life. That February the 23rd of 1989, I should say February the 22nd of 1989, I absolutely was hopeless. And from my first meeting, I sensed the power of a sense of hope that I didn't get from anything else I had tried up until that point. Right? A bunch of people took me out to dinner afterwards. Well, it didn't take me out to dinner. It was about 25 people went out to dinner after this meeting that had about 100 people in it. They were laughing and they were talking. And the speaker at that meeting was funny, and didn't know what to make of all this stuff. But it was certainly better than what I was experiencing. I sensed that there was certainly something here, and they talked about that God thing, and it really kind of pissed me off at the meeting when I heard people mentioning God, and the back of my hair would raise, like, you know, oh, you know, here it comes, right? Right? And you heard people say, you need to get a sponsor and find someone that has what you want, and I looked around the room going, oh, this is going to be difficult. Right? And I wasn't sure that I really would need one of these sponsor things. I rarely put myself in a position for anybody to tell me what to do, right, or how to live, right. But I don't know that I knew what this thing was about, but I certainly knew that I didn't want the life that I'd had, and this window of opportunity opened up for me, right. And I call it this window of opportunity because I believe when we come in here, something has to happen in between that window, right, for us to stay. Right? And with some people, nothing happens inside that window and they just don't stay. Right? And what happens is different for different people. And I think that, you know, I'm not one to say that there's as many ways to work the program as there is people in it, as I've heard said in some meetings. I believe that the program that I found is perfect for me, right, and the only one that I would share with anybody. But I also understand that not everybody wants to do what I do, right? And not everybody is attracted to what I do, right? Not everybody is attracted to what other people in your own home group does, right? But somehow, in this whole big picture, Alcoholics Anonymous has created this really big net, right? And if you don't like one meeting, you go to another one, and hopefully you hook up with some people or some other, or click with a different message that what you're hearing, that's enough to keep you to keep you interested enough to get, or excited enough to stick with it a little longer and just get something here. So I didn't get a sponsor right away, right? I started interviewing people though, right? 'Cause obviously it had to be the right sponsor, right? Not just anyone would do. I always heard people say, find someone that has what you want, right? Made sense, right? So I was still assuming that what I needed to put back together is my old life, right? Because I thought that this was all about getting my old way of life back, and thank God that's not what I got, right? But thinking that it was about what I thought I needed was the right relationship and enough money and a nice car. I live in LA, right? So that makes sense, right? So I would interview people based on that. What are they driving? What do they do for a living? What does their girlfriend or wife look like? What do their friends look like? Are they cool or are they, you know? How much time do they have for me? if you've talked to a lot of newcomers, you hear that a lot, and it's, they just didn't have enough time for me, right? I mean, one guy actually wanted me to ride with him to a meeting so he could talk to me while we're on the way to the meeting. And I thought, and now I understand that was, you know, for someone like this, that was a big deal, but I wanted nothing to do with it. I wanted, just thought a little bit too much of myself I thought I needed more. But I did go on this, I did try. I did ask people to sponsor me. In fact, I had asked 5 people to sponsor me in my first 9 months and did a little bit with each one of them and quickly lost interest in them. Well, I was coming up with better things to do than they were. let me add that it had nothing to do with the big book, all right? Right, there's these pamphlets from over here and this book from over there, and you know, in Los Angeles, I don't know if you have them here, but they have 12-step stores, like recovery stores. They sell all kinds of books and mugs with years on them and jewelry, and you know, so you go in and you buy this book and that tape and this, and you know, anything but the big book. I mean, I read the big book, but I read the stories, right? Because that's what they did in book studies. They read the stories. And I was one of those that said, you know, those people back there did that, but, you know, that's nothing to do with me. Always keeping it out here. I ended up back with Brian, the guy that brought me into the fifth sponsor. The guy that brought me into the meetings, because I kind of got frustrated and said, okay, Brian, you can sponsor me, right? Because he didn't sponsor anybody. He drove a Volkswagen. He was a plumber, right? And this is the guy whose first 2 girlfriends committed suicide, so he kind of stayed away from women. He had nothing that I wanted, right? But he did have a little bit of peace about him, right? He liked his life, right? And I didn't realize it at the time, but looking back, I see that there was, you know, that was enough, you know, and he actually turned out to be one of the better ones, but the problem with Brian is I think that he didn't actually finish himself, and he took me as far as he could, I was his only sponsee ever, but I don't think he had finished with his own sponsor, as I said. So when it got to 10 and 11, he said, go find an 11-step meeting. And, you know, that was probably the best thing I could have possibly heard at that time, because by that time, I wanted more. Right? With all my sponsors that I'd had up to that point, I had done a autobiographical inventory, which told me a whole bunch of stuff that I already knew, but now you know it too, right? And I was able to elaborate on it so that you could see how much of a victim I was. You know, I did these 50 questions in a pamphlet, fourth step, from some hospital in the United States. I answered the ones that I thought applied and adjusted the ones that I thought weren't quite right, right? And was very satisfied when I finished that thing, right? But the new sponsor that I got to read it, listen to it in a fifth step, actually fell asleep real quick in the middle of it. So I kept reading because I really wanted to finish, right? Then another sponsor gave me these check boxes, right? Actually, Brian gave me these checkbox inventories where you, did this apply? Yes, yes, yes. Which didn't necessarily give me a lot of insight, but I certainly felt good finishing it. At least the first two columns felt good. They did this to me, right? I think that was probably where the majority of the experience came from at the time, at least from that inventory, right? Because it validated my right to feel about the way I felt about those people, right? But it didn't give me any new information. And that was the same thing that was true of all of those inventories. No change, no difference in my thinking. You know, and something had to happen, and I didn't understand it at the time. I think, you know, and it's going to tell us, Carl Jung talks about what he believed we needed, because what he saw in alcoholics that did recover, is where he talks about ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were once the guiding forces in the lives of these men, are suddenly cast to one side, and a new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them. Right? If an inventory doesn't do that for me, nothing up here in my mind is going to change. Right? My attitude is not going to change. Right? So basically, coming out of all of these times through the steps, I had certainly gotten to where I'd gotten, but I was still hungry for more. And he told me to go to this, to find this 11-step meeting, is what he said. And I opened up the book in Santa Monica. It happened to be on a Tuesday, and there it was, Tuesday at 7:30. The steps 10, 11, and 12 meeting is what it was called at the time. I figured that's what I was directed to go to. Steps 10, 11, and 12. So I went to that meeting, and they talked funny there. They didn't talk like I was listening, like the way I was used to hearing people talk in other meetings. Right? They weren't talking about being powerless. They were talking about living with power. Still talked a little bit too much about the God thing, right? Because I wasn't quite open to that. But by that time, I had about 8 months, 9 months, and I was getting used to hearing it, right? And used to blocking it out. And you couldn't share at that meeting unless you'd finished the ninth step. If you hadn't finished the ninth step, you could only ask questions. Right? And the meeting was full of people that said that they had finished the ninth step, all of their amends. Right? And that was curious, because I was going to most of the meetings that I had gone to up to that point, they said, you'll never finish. Right? And here's, they were talking about finishing, and they were talking about, you know, over and over again, you were hearing people raise their hands and say, I finished, and they talk about their experience with finishing. Right? And it was certainly curious to me, because something was going on here that was different. I didn't understand what it was, right? But they were doing something different. So I started going every week to that meeting, and it became my home group, and I got a sponsor in that group. And it happened to be Joe H., the person that Jeanette mentioned. He had come out here 5 years ago, 10 years ago? No, I guess it must be 12 years ago. How long ago was it, Jeanette?
12?
12. It was a long time ago, okay. And basically, he didn't do anything really strange except started guiding me through the big book, right? And the meeting takes a lot of flack, like that group over there does this weird stuff, like, you know, but really, the group is really open to logical explanations to what the big book says, right? And as long as it can be validated with the big book, it's more than accepted at the group, right? It's the stuff that can't be validated with the big book that you get in trouble for talking about there, because it's also a crosstalk meeting, and it's a meeting that you can share on other people's shares, right? Right. So, people that come into it expecting it to be like just like every other meeting sometimes don't come back, especially if they try to share like they do in every other meeting. It's gotten a lot nicer. I think everybody's grown a lot since 20 years ago when I started, but it used to be bloody. It was like somebody would, with a lot of time, would come and speak, and people would say, well, where is that in the big book, and do you think that maybe this is what's really going on there, or you know, why haven't you finished your amends, 30 years sobriety, and right? The questions were scary, just the way that it was presented. It was more like interrogation, right? But I was safe because I was new and I hadn't got there yet. I can't share. But it was sure fun to watch the sparring, and it really caught my interest a lot more than what I refer to as this unsupervised group therapy meetings, right? Where people every week talk about the same problems over and over again, right? Which sometimes people need to do that. I understand that, right? So it has a place, but talking about my problems over and over again never got rid of my problems, right? What I saw was, in my experience over the years, is that just getting time in the program doesn't give me power, right? Doesn't change my attitude, doesn't change, you know, we certainly do grow, right? But there's things that I can get from the 12-step process that I couldn't have got anywhere else. And this is a 12-step program, right? Right? And I'm not saying you have to do the 12 steps like I do the 12 steps, but it's good if you're in a 12-step program to at least do the 12 steps, right? And hopefully have an experience with what that means. Right? And with that, you know, I try not to separate people. I am real passionate about what I do, but I realize not everybody has to do it exactly how I do it. And my hope isn't that all of you switched it my way, right? That's not what I expect. I just hope that maybe I get somebody excited about doing something, and even if it's further into your own direction, I don't care. You know, I'm just glad to be out here and be able to participate in what's such a big part of my life now, right? I do think that what I do is perfect for me, right? And I wouldn't want to do it any other way. Although I have done it other ways, I've gone through the steps with other people just to experience different processes and different ideas that other people have about what the big book says. But the people I choose are all people that are familiar with the big book, but approach it from different angles, right? First 12 years, I probably went through once a year with various people. And after that, it kind of, I did some stuff that really put me in a good place, and I didn't I didn't feel I had to do it as often, right? But at the time, everybody in my home group was doing it once a year, right? And it's like, it may sound obsessive, but nobody makes anybody do it like that. But if you find something that really excites you and gives you a lot, and you just get really moved by it, right? And you find out that doing it again just takes you to a new experience with that, you get excited about doing it again, right? And that was what I saw is every time I did it, it worked in some way. And I wouldn't say it always necessarily took me to a higher level. See, the reason that it continues to work is not because I believe, because it can continue to take you to a higher level, although sometimes, depending on where you start, it certainly can. But there's a part of me that has the ability to get blocked spiritually. And what I found was is that when I'm open to doing a spiritual exercise to get me closer to that spiritual place, right? The 12-step process will work over and over again to chip away at the new things, the new delusions, the new things, the new areas of powerlessness in my life, right? The new things that separate me from God, right? And, so these were theories and ideas that I learned from the people in my home group, because I saw those people go through over and over again, and those people talk about what it's like to finish amends, and here those people talk about what it's like to go through the process again. All right, so I trusted their experience, and what I learned was is I wanted what they experienced. I wanted what they had, but not out here. There was something in here that they had, and I saw that I didn't have what they had. Right, but what was different about this is that they had a systematic way to take me down this path, completely guided by the Big Book. And with that, there's a lot of opinions. A lot of people like to use the 12 and 12, right? Except if you read the first step in the 12 and 12 critically, there's 4 pages, and every time it refers to the first step, it refers to you already talking to your sponsor about it, right? 12 and 12 is great to read, I think, after you've had an experience with the 12 steps. And it has certainly a lot of good information, right? Especially later on, beyond the first step. But I believe that the reason that it was set up that way is because after 15 years of not having anything that got in the way of the Big Book, that the 12 and 12 was never designed to replace the Big Book, right? But it was so easily accepted because how many people could you ask, where's step one in the Big Book? Right? Where's step two? It tells you when you get to step three and every step along the way after that, but before that it doesn't discuss it. Right? So I could see where it would be so much easier just to pick up a book that says, here's step one. Right? So when I saw here was is that, and what the biggest difference in this group was is that they had a simple set of instructions to use the Big Book, and that was different than any other sponsor that I had tried before that. And I saw that it was going to be a lot of work, right? And it looked like it was going to take a while, right? But then I wasn't going anywhere. At least I was hoping I wasn't going anywhere, right? But more important, I think it was the example of the people that have done it, right? And I think that was the bigger drive for it, right? And there was another thing that was happening. It was all those friends that I had when I was new, they weren't all still around, right? There was people that I was really close to that we went to meetings 2 times a day, every day, sometimes 3 times a day. There's a lot of meetings in Los Angeles. On a Friday, you can go to a morning meeting, a noon meeting, an afternoon meeting, an evening meeting, a nighttime meeting, like a midnight meeting, right? And then get up in the morning for the beach meeting. Right? There's a lot of meetings where I am. So I went to a lot of meetings, but so I developed these relationships with people who didn't stay, who seemed to be doing what I was doing. And they were going to a lot of meetings. Right? I thought that going to a lot of meetings meant that I must have a good program. I thought that if I memorized enough cool things to say that I heard from other speakers, and I could sound good, then it would mean I'd have a good program. Right? And what I saw is that I can certainly sound well without being well. Right? I can paint a picture out here that's a lot prettier than the picture that's in here. Right? And I've seen people die from that. Right? Die in that place. Not only newcomers, but people with 20 years and 25 years and 30 years, where they go out and drink again and just kill themselves. Right? I've had close friends. One just died a few months ago. Just wouldn't buy the whole package. Right? He asked me to sponsor him, and I tried to, and we played together when we were young. I've known him, he was like my oldest friend, and they found him dead in a garage. He overdosed. And I told him while I was working with him, I says, I could not stay sober the way you're staying sober. Right? I could not approach this program like you are and stay sober. And he didn't want to believe that. He didn't want to buy the whole package. And it's not that it's that difficult, you know. I mean, how many of you have sponsees and you look at them and you see that you're going to more meetings than they are, right? And it's not that meetings will keep you sober, but it's certainly an indicator of whether you're excited about the program you're in, right? Or involved in the program you're in. So, seeing all this happening around me, as I said, it gave me a lot of hope. And there was a lot of work to do. But I was given this work a little bit at a time. And I didn't know if I was going to have what these other people had. Right, but I had to take that leap of faith that if I was going to be different than what I was at that time when I was new, right, in my first year, that I had to do something more than what I was doing. And I saw by the example of this group that there was something here for me. And if you would have told me that I would. That it would have turned into what it's turned into for me, then I couldn't have perceived it back then. But it's taken a life that was so useless, right, and made that person who was so useless so effective that I'm able to work with people, and not because I'm able to get anybody sober, right, but I get to feed them the same process that was fed to me a little bit at a time, and watch them wake up a little bit at a time. You know, anybody that's worked with somebody through the 12-step process probably has had the experience of talking to the person they're working with and just have their eyes just all of a sudden just open up a little bit after they've realized something. And you know that something clicked deep down inside of them that's woken them up to a truth that they absolutely didn't know before that, and that's just not something that I created in them. It's just something that the 12-step process has done in them, and you can see it happen. And you know it wasn't you, and there must be something flowing through you, right, that caused this to happen. Right? And what I'd like to do tomorrow is talk about how I walk through that simple process and how I work with people, right? And lay that out for you. And um, You know, and anything I say, I believe I can validate with what the big book says, right? And if you see anything different in what the big book says, then I'm wrong and you're right, all right? I'm not here to, you know, not here to do anything weird. I know my group, some people call my group in Los Angeles kind of cultish, right? But you know, there's much bigger groups than mine. There's a group in my area that has 1,000 people every Wednesday, right? You know, and it looks way more cultish than my group. You know, better. See, even people out here are familiar with it, right? You know, because they, you know, people stay sober a long time in both groups, right? And it goes back to what I said in the beginning, you know, find what you're passionate about and get involved and live it, right? If you prefer the social aspect and the social kind of group better than a structured group that's like a workhorse group, then that's fine. But just getting completely involved in it, you know. But sometimes what happens, there's people that certainly that really love that kind of arena. But I get a lot of people with 20 to 30 years that have been in that arena for so long, and they're dying, that they're not getting what they need, right? And they can appreciate something new, right? That there's another way. Right, because certainly after 20 or 25 years, you can say, well, this is all Alcoholics Anonymous is. There's nothing for me to get than what I've got, right? After 2 decades, 3 decades, right? Right? What more could I possibly get? Right? And I love working with people like that. I just finished working with someone with 25 years. He's just got into the 12-step for the first time. 25 years, never worked with anybody once, right? He's been resistant, but he's not safe around me because he's going to get somebody if I have to assign someone to him, right? But because he's a little scared because after 25 years they're not doing anything. But, you know, but he's going to be a great sponsor, right? But he's such a great example of someone that's hung around thinking that there's no more for him than just going to meetings. And then he's done all this stuff now through the big book and it's just changed. He's changed, and he's got some simple instructions. He's got something to sit down with someone and take them through, right? You hear that a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know how to sponsor someone. I don't know how to take them through the big book, right? Well, and usually it's because, you know, because you just haven't tried it yet, right? Or you haven't worked with somebody that's taken you through it. Right, and so I think I've talked enough for tonight. Tomorrow at 9:30, we're going to come back, and I'm going to talk about what it is that what was presented to me, and how I present it to others, and you know, hopefully you'll be able to pick up parts of it that either you haven't heard or that you like, or you know. Or enough information to walk away saying, "Oh, that guy's full of shit." Right? But I was joking about that because I really believe that I'm going to just be taking parts out of the big book and talking about my experience, right? And your experience with that part might be different, but my experience is my experience. And if you haven't been exposed to this, I think you'll enjoy it. So have a good night, and thanks for coming. Thanks.